June 9th, 2012, and we're in the President Hotel in London. I'm with John Saul. Could you first just introduce yourself?
Well, I don't know what to emphasize. I have been a long-time liberation support, anti-apartheid activist, and was very much involved in that in Canada for many years. But I had first got interested in Africa when I was here at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies as a student in 64-5. I was en route to Tanzania to do research for my doctorate. I had done my B and MA at the U of T, University of Toronto, and then I went to Princeton. And I had got a foreign area fellowship of some kind to come to England and then go to Tanzania to do research. And I took Swahili lessons at SOAS and took some seminars down at the LSE as well as at the ICS. And then I went off to Tanzania and I was there for 7 years. I went originally for 6 months to do research, but it was right during the middle of the Arusha Declaration period, so I got a job and stayed there for a long time. And also when I was in Tanzania, I got more interest in Southern Africa work and Southern Africa-related politics as well as Southern Africa-related research. So then when I came back to Canada in 72, a group of us started the Toronto Committee for Liberation of Southern Africa, and I remained active. I both got a job at York University and also remained active in the anti-apartheid movement, and we had a magazine that went on right into this century. Finally ran out of steam nearly part of the century, called Southern Africa Report. So I was enlisted here in London as a lifer, in a way, in the Africa struggle as well as in the African studies.
Mm-hmm. And at that point, had you been introduced to other areas of activism?
Well, I'll tell you, partly when I was here, the ICS was a place where lots of things were being talked about. And Stan Torpedo, who has written a lot on South Africa, was a fellow student of mine at the ICS. And I also took a seminar with Ralph Miliband, who became quite a close friend. And I published a lot in the Socialist Register during his time and more recently. But in his seminar was Harold Wolpe, who just fled jail in South Africa, came to London and was retooling himself as a sociologist. So we were in the seminar together. So I had a sort of introduction to South Africa. Well, I knew something about it from before, but I had never been very active around it in Canada or when I lived in the States. But I got more interested. And then when I did get to Tanzania, that was the center of a lot of the liberation movement. Well, all of the liberation movements for struggles further south. I became particularly close to the people in Frelimo, and I used to do some work for them as well as teach my courses and do some research in Tanzania too. I got some contacts with South Africa. I remember at one point I was instructed by the head of the department the next day to start teaching a course on Southern African politics because the professor who was going to do that had been delayed or gone away or done something. I can't remember the full story. And so I became an instant expert, more or less overnight, you know, one jump ahead of the students doing my lectures and so on. So that was the context within, because Dar es Salaam was the center of a lot of these liberation movements at that time. Many moved to Lusaka, displaced the center of their activities to Lusaka. But Mozambique was always right just below Tanzania, so that was the most active of the movements that I was aware of, and I got very, very involved with them, to a lesser degree with the others as well, including the ANC. That kind of drew me into it. And when I left Tanzania finally in 1972, I kind of had the idea in the back of my mind that I would come back, write up what I'd done in Tanzania, possibly get my PhD from Princeton for having done so. And then get into some subjects that I could research on the ground closer to home. But just before I left Tanzania, I was invited by Samora Machel himself, the head of the army, to visit to go with Frelimo guerrillas into Tet province in Mozambique, where the armed struggle was going on. So I went for a month and did that, and it was a kind of a quite a formative experience. And I remember when I came back, I saw him shortly before I ultimately left in 72 from Tanzania. He said, "The knowledge of in Canada of our struggle is at this level," and he holds his fingers out like that, you know, minuscule. And he said, "I want you to go and do something about that." So it's almost like I got a directive from on high, you know. So I did then, but I was already moving in that direction. When I came back, I did write up a thesis, which, unfortunately, I'd been 7 years in Tanzania, and I'd learned too much in a way, so I had my own way of thinking about what was happening in Africa that many of us had worked on while we were in Dar, the so-called Dar es Salaam school and so on. So I couldn't write a thesis that was quite acceptable at Princeton. This was just after the Vietnam War, and the professoriate had been on the defensive during that Vietnam War, but now they were back asserting their right to rule, if you like, the university, and so they wouldn't accept my thesis. I never did get that doctorate, but I, you know, did get a job finally and lived happily ever after at York University. But more importantly, I was involved from then on in the liberation struggle. At first we had a Toronto Committee for the Liberation of Portugal's African Colonies. Then, of course, they became independent, and so we expanded to the Toronto Committee for the Liberation of Southern Africa, and then South Africa came into focus as a main player in all of that. I became increasingly involved in that work, too. So, and the rest is history, as they say.
And at what point did you encounter Ruth first?
Well, I think, you know, my memory of it is a little bit hazy. I think I met her for the first time at a party at Harold Wolpe's, who I mentioned earlier. She was a great friend of Harold's, and she had herself only recently come to London. I won't claim to have known her well then. I got to know her a little bit better when I, after I came out from Tanzania. I didn't really know her well during the time I was in Tanzania, although I came back to London from time to time. I didn't really know her. I knew of her, of course, and Joe Slovo. But I was involved in the early years of the Review of African Political Economy, ROPE, and she was involved in that too. But I was involved to some degree at a distance because I never came back to live in England after my year or two here at the ICS. In the mid-60s, so this is now we're in the 70s, ROPE starts up and I'm involved in that because many of the people who are most active, like Lionel Cliff and Peter Lawrence and others, had been with me in Dar for many, many years, so these are old friends. So I met Ruth a number of times during that period that ROPE was starting, and she was, of course, doing all kinds of other things, and I knew her work and so on. We were friends, friendly, during that time, and I saw her at several conferences and so on, but I wasn't here in London, so I didn't really, or in England, I didn't really have a, you know, very close relationship with her, but I was aware of her work as I think she was of mine, and we exchanged ideas and so on a bit. But when I really got to know her well was when I went to Mozambique again in the early 80s. She was already there and at the Center of African Studies, so we were quite good friends there, although we'd been sort of had a friendship in the background during all these more recent years. Mm-hmm. And but there we were working together, although I wasn't at the Center of African Studies. I was, I said this the other day at the workshop, you know, I was in the Faculty of Marxism-Leninism. So I said, try putting that on your CV these days. But that's what I was doing. So I was there to kind of as an antidote to the, in the eyes of some of the Frelimo people I knew quite well, to the Eastern European deadening hand over what was being taught as Marxism in the heyday of the Mozambican Revolution. And I also taught at the party school of Frelimo. But my office was only about three doors away from where Ruth was and where she eventually died. And I was there for a year or so, and then I was leaving, and this is the anecdotal because it's not really the center of the story by any means, but it was close to me, obviously. She was having a party for my departure. I was leaving the next day to go to return to Canada with my family. And she was having a party across the hall from her office in another room. And I suppose I would have been in her office. But anyway, I drove into the parking lot just in front of the building when the explosion that killed her occurred. So I was, you know, it was again a minor footnote. I was pretty close to it, and close to her for that matter. So it was a pretty horror. And then I spent the rest of the day, the rest of the night, really, the police investigation. We were all interrogated and discussed and asked our opinions and so on. It was quite clear that it was sent from South Africa, and that's of course what history has shown, but they were being quite thorough in investigating it and so on. So, and then I, unfortunately, I had an arrangement with my mother to visit Ireland, where her family had come from. And so I had to leave, more or less. I was a day or two later than I had expected, but I couldn't stay for the memorial services, which I've always felt badly about. But my old mom, who was 80-something or other, I had to... She was waiting for me in Dublin, so... Anyway, it was a very chilling experience. And I can remember... my son had a rather strong commonsensical idea, because they were young kids, my daughter and my son. And sometime later I said something, but I'm going back on a trip to Mozambique, and Nick, my son, he was about in his teenage years anyway, he said, oh gee, Dad, I don't know whether I'd do that after, you know, we were there for that horrible event and so on. And he said, I said, well, Nick, you got to be careful. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to scare us. And he said, they're sure succeeding with me. Anyway, so life goes on.
Yeah. Was there a sense of that kind of threat in Maputo,
well,
or in the center?
Not that kind of threat exactly. There had been, of course, other examples of bombs and interventions in Zimbabwe and the like. And of course, there had been raids on Maputo from the air, not targeted at the university or any university personnel. And Joseph himself, you always could assume, was some kind of a target. I was always a little bit discomforted. I'd see him in town and he'd say, do you want a lift back to the university? And I'd say, well, okay. And then we'd just get in his car and drive off, you know. And that happened to me with Albie Sachs, too. I used to occasionally go swimming with him in his car. Well, that was the car that eventually blew up, almost killed him, and of course took his arm. So you were aware that the South Africans were not absent from the scene, but there was had not yet been a visible attack or threat at the university per se. So I think, you know, it was startling. It was horrible in every way, as you can imagine. I don't need to stress that, but it was startling as well that it happened where it did and so brazenly. I don't think anybody could have predicted it was going to happen. And Ruth certainly was a target, potentially. Although Joe, you might have suspected, would have been more of a target. But they chose to do her, and we knew it was the South Africans. And of course, there was some debate about it and so on, who did this and that. But then, of course, now with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, if you've read Gillian Slovo's book, she was there during the when Craig Williamson was interviewed by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And of course, he got off scot-free because he admitted to doing it. But he said it was, I'm so sure it was, part of his official duties to kill somebody on behalf of the apartheid state. And so, in the terms of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, he walks away scot-free from that. And a friend of mine, just not so long ago, was telling me how one of the most galling things about his kid at school in Johannesburg is that he walks every day across the field taking his kid to school, and he looks over and there's Craig Williamson taking his kid to the same school. So that's, you know, that one could debate the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but, you know, on the whole, it did some honest work, but it had that catch. So this is part of the settlement, was that these people, Craig Williamson not least, got away with cold-blooded murder. And Ruth First is one of the most obvious victim of that.
I know, obviously, Ruth First and you and others in Mozambique had an opportunity to not just think about but participate in what Mozambique would be like after independence.
Yeah.
Did you discuss what South Africa might look like or how you might proceed once it became independent?
I certainly... I mean, it's a good question, and you know, as you heard in my talk, I raise this obliquely. I mean, on the one hand, you don't want to discuss contemporary South Africa mainly while at a conference celebrating Ruth First and her life. So it becomes a kind of a add-on question, which is not irrelevant, but it's speculative, hugely speculative. The one thing I thought was kind of interesting was that my talk ended, as you recall, on a somewhat interrogative note. You know, I read this quote from Rusty Bernstein that he sent me just before he himself died 20 years later, saying that how disappointed he was in what had happened in South Africa. And certainly, I don't know whether disappointed is the word, but certainly I'm a bit shaken by the course that has been taken by the ANC. And I raised the question, but just raised it, you know, what would Ruth have thought? Because it's one of the things I felt very strongly, and I said this in my talk, was I miss hearing her voice now. Because I think she would not have gone quite so politely towards this kind of recolonization, as I call it, of South Africa by global capital. And I was interested that Gillian Slovo, the last voice to be heard at the conference, more or less ended on the same note. She was picked up particularly this recent press laws and said Ruth First would have stood up against those. You know, I think it's a good question. What would she have thought about the turning of its back by the ANC on any form of socialist or transformative economy? The notion that capital will do the heavy lifting and we can tweak the edges in a way that's going to service the population. Well, I don't think many of them really care, unfortunately, and I don't think that's the way change can happen in Africa anyway, because capital's not interested in transforming the economy. They're interested in getting profits out, and you know, that's a long story, but I just don't think that's going to happen. So I think I knew Ruth well enough to at least suspect, but again, it's all supposition, so you can't really build anything on it. She would have asked some embarrassing questions. Whether she would have ever felt the need to break with the ANC, I mean, I supported the ANC during the struggle, but I've certainly broken with it, who cares what I think? You know, it's not that important, but I happen to, you know, have aligned myself with the Democratic Left Front to some degree, and I'm looking for a new counter-hegemonic alternative, if you like, to the ANC, but that's a small beer, really. It would have been interesting to know what she might have done. And I think there's enough reason for us to realize her principles to suspect that she would have at least been very critical from inside. I don't know that she would have ever broken with the party, or either the Communist Party or the ANC, but I think she would have been a troublemaker, a shit disturber, really. Said, you know, she would have asked some embarrassing questions, and I think she would have continued as Gillian. You know, this talk was insofar as Joe Slovo was mentioned at this conference, it was about his constant quarrels with Ruth, and they're over political matters, at least among other things, who knows. But he, I think, went along rather more comfortably with the real move right of the whole ANC. I don't think Ruth would have taken that quite so graciously. Now, mind you, he was very ill at the end, and so on. I'm not pretending there's a comment on him. You know, that would be a different kind of discussion. But I think she would have found it hard to swallow what they'd done. But who knows? I mean, you know, I know this from others like Ben Turok and people like that that I know well, who can see that there's something not quite right about what's happening, but they are party loyalists in the end, and they're trying to figure out a way to both raise a certain number of questions and still remain loyal. I think some people, of course, have broken with it, and new efforts are being made. And in fact, in South Africa at the moment, I think there's the highest rate of visible local protests of anywhere in the world, with the possible exception of China, where there's quite a lot of grassroots-based protest. So in South Africa, it's a very high level. It hasn't yet accumulated into what I call a counter-hegemonic alternative. The DLF is trying to think it could do that. Others may be starting to think about it. It's not easy. If you look at Southern Africa more generally, each one of the countries who rhetorically, now Mozambique more than anywhere else was meant it actually in practice, was left and looked towards socialism, if you want to call it that, but certainly a challenging alternative that would have centered the activity of the economy more self-consciously on national needs and national distribution, redistribution, and so on. All of these liberation movements are still in power. You know, some really at the point of a gun, like in Zimbabwe. But they've all changed. Now some of them haven't changed that much. They were always, you know, not really very left. But they've all rhetorically changed. And in the Mozambican case, and to some degree I think that's true of the ANC as well, although it was never a, quote, socialist movement, the SACP was that. But the SACP and ANC have both moved to an accommodation with global capital, which is not a very developmental option. And in fact, as we know, the gap in income between black and white has narrowed somewhat since apartheid has been done. It's been narrowed because some blacks are now quite well off in the current system. But the gap between rich and poor has widened. So it's not a happy prospect in South Africa. And as the people begin to get some sense of that, some more sense of that, which they already are showing at the local level, not yet so much at the national level, then the dangers of the situation becoming more repressive to hold the ANC elite in power, which is what we see in this press law, I think, that Gillian was talking about, the closing down of room, of space, for alternative voices to be heard, becomes more and more probable, and so on. You know, I think South Africa, I think, is at a coming towards a crossroads. I mean, there was a period in Zimbabwe where it happened. The MDC, at least at the beginning, was a progressive movement. It's now had so many years of being denied power. It's won 4 or 5 elections, none of which has been allowed to win. And in the course of it, it's been eaten away in some ways from principle and so on. But I think a MDC-type movement is a possibility in the long run in South Africa. Whether it will be allowed to happen and what that will look like remains a very big question. And I think these are questions, you know, not to stray from the topic, I think these are questions that Ruth would have had to ask herself. I think she was just too principled, too aware of, as her other writing in Africa, with the power barrel of a gun, and these writings about how in many instances in Africa, following Fanon or other important theorists, independence had soured into a elite-driven and project by the powers that be, but in conjunction with global capital. I think Ruth would have had to ask herself some tough questions, and I think she was gutsy enough to ask them, even though the pressure, partly from Joe having been so prominent in the movement, partly because she herself had been prominent in the movement for so long, it would have been hard for her to ask the kind of fundamental questions that I think need asking. And of course, we can never know what would have happened. This is all speculative. But I think she would have been more likely than most to have been felt herself forced to say, hey, wait a minute, what the hell are you guys up to? And mainly, there are many guys, which she wouldn't have failed to note as well. So, who knows? I mean, then at that level, this is a good question, but it's a question that by its very nature is totally speculative. One can hunch what she might have thought, and certainly I felt I knew, although I didn't know her as well as some of the others here who worked so closely with her, I knew her well enough to have some sense of her integrity and her strength of will and character. I think she would have perhaps asked questions, but there's not much more you can say than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand it's speculative, but I think it was appropriate for you to raise that at the symposium, just because her history and her influence isn't at an end. And
well, I think that's true. And I tried to do it as you heard. I mean, I mentioned that I had a view, but people can read the Social Register or whatever if they want to find out what I think. But Rusty Bernstein was a close friend of hers and a comrade of similar length of time, and his wife, Hilda Bernstein. They were major comrades within the struggle. And he wrote that very, very searching final letter to me, not of all people in a way. I was surprised to receive it. But it's a very critical look at what, I think he liked an article that I had done in the Monthly Review recently, that got him more articulate externally than he had been. But he asked a significant range of tough questions. And those are questions I think Ruth might have had trouble not asking, if you see what I mean. So I think it's important. But you can only say it, you can't really then go on. But I was glad that Jillian kind of ended on that query note. And somebody told me over dinner that night that she was elaborated on that. I happened not to be sitting with her, but she elaborated on that. Certainly this press law and so on have also rocked some people's confidence, although I think many people's confidence were rocked by the absolute embrace of neoliberalism that the ANC underwent. Now, there's a debate about the ANC as to whether this was to be expected of them. I mean, Thabo Mbeki wrote an article, of all places, in the Canadian African Studies Journal back at the turn of the 80s, in which he said, the ANC is not a socialist party. We don't want to be in any way claim that. And he does sort of acknowledge that maybe the SACP is guarding the socialist conscience or something. But, he's very clear about it. So you could say, well, it's not that surprising that the ANC became this agent, and if you like, of what I call recolonization. But, that is somewhat easier for me, although, we were associated with the ANC. Although we got into trouble even as a liberation support movement in the 1970s and 80s, because we took the position of critical support, and because we had some questions we had to raise. If you read, for example, the African Communist of those days, or even Sashaba, it was a diplomatically necessary, but maybe rather too enthusiastic embrace of the Soviet line. Well, we know they were dependent on the Soviet Union for aid, and that's not military aid, which is no small thing. But it was a bit disconcerting, and one maybe not need not be terribly surprised, because what we have now, I think, is a forthrightly capitalist system on the ANC's watch in South Africa, with the ANC nonetheless still carrying some of the weight. Although they do have a democracy, to give them a formal democracy, there's still a kind of a communist party structure related to it. And so that, like in China, we have a capitalist China with a communist party holding power. Now they hold power in a one-party state mode. In South Africa, it's more open, but they have the kind of a hegemonic grip. And I think that may be shaping their current reactions, because as this society becomes more complicated, more diverse, and more mobilized towards protest, I don't think that we can necessarily hold out the hope that South Africa won't follow, the ANC won't follow a similar route. And I remember Jeremy Cronin, you know, well-known minister in South Africa, a long-time activist, he said a few years ago he saw the danger of a Xenification of the ANC. He very quickly climbed down from that position because there was quite a strong reaction from within the party against his saying that. But I think he was probably right the first time. That's what one must fear is on the cards as contradictions in South Africa ripen. And they will, because more and more people are more and more desperate. This is not... Capitalism doesn't work in Africa. I mean, it has worked in North America and in England up to a point, but starting to show some fray at the edges, of course, even here. But in South Africa or other African parts, it doesn't really work. South Africa is somewhat privileged because it has some capital from its mining past, if you like, and even present, to become a bit of a semi-imperial power vis-a-vis local states. I mean, I went back to Dar es Salaam a few years ago. I lived there for a long time. And you walk down the street and you see about every second store now is a South African chain. So there is a South African presence economically in control of the rest of the regional economy and further afield as well. But it hasn't changed things in South Africa very much in terms of redistribution. If anything, as I said earlier, the redistribution has taken a backward step. The gap between rich and poor is wider. Well, that can't stay that way forever. Then you say, well, could it lead to a socialist revolution or whatever the equivalent would be, an environmentally conscious, gender-sensitive, left-wing movement of some kind? Well, it could lead to that. It could as easily lead to rising crime rates, xenophobia against neighbors. We've seen these in South Africa. It could rot out. And it could, of course, also lead to a state that becomes more repressive, which these recent moves on the press seem to indicate is more than just a long-term possibility, but could be a present danger. So, we'll see. But I think the situation is not a particularly happy one, and to bring it back to Ruth first, I don't think she would have kept quiet about it. But who knows?
When you were first becoming involved in activist communities or communities in London that would have supported African independence, was there a relatively uniform opinion that socialist or Marxist structures would be the most successful or useful model for African states?
I'd say no. Amongst those that I knew, the people that I worked with most closely, there was that sense. Certainly, taking the British situation, it requires its own analysis in the sense that they had the anti-apartheid movement here, which was quite heavily influenced by the CP, but the CP wasn't that radical. But it also kept a kind of control over local initiatives of a kind, which we in Canada fought against, having that kind of national organization. The Canadian CP, which is a pretty weak reed, fortunately anyway there, wanted to have that model, but we became the Toronto Committee for the Liberation of Southern Africa. We did our work in Toronto, because that's where we were, and we linked to other initiatives that were taking place across the country, but in a much more looser kind of format than anything that was parallel to the anti-apartheid movement. But I think, you know, we had a lot of support from churches and from other kinds of groups, non-governmental organizations, CUSO and SUCO and a variety of other such organizations. But it's hard to say. I think we certainly pushed a left line from Tickelsack, but the unity was based on primarily the enormity of the racist structure. We made it clear in our own work that the racist structure was not unrelated to the capitalist structure. And we also saw that as Moroni was moving, he was moving to consolidate capitalism, even if it meant at the expense of racism. So we had that position, which I think was correct, but we didn't spend all our time articulating a left, or as what might have been seen as an ultra-left position. We worked with a lot of people who, across the board, were anti-apartheid and or pro-liberation movement in the other countries as well, with some pull, if you like, to a left perspective. And since our work in part grew out of our early initial links to Frelimo in particular, Frelimo was trying, briefly at least, a socialist alternative. So I think there were those who were in Canada, say, I do know the British scene, but I know it more from a distance. In the Canadian scene, there was a unity around the centrality of the enormity of apartheid per se, and a sense that, on the part of the left wing of that movement, that this is not unrelated to capitalism. And as you look more closely, what was happening is that capitalism was becoming more and more reform-minded in racial terms, but as parasitic as ever in economic terms. Well, by and large, I don't think that was the general position of people who were necessarily against apartheid. And in fact, although we continued our Southern Africa report right up until about 2001, a decade after the final liberation of South Africa, with the death of formal apartheid, the issue kind of began to vanish. We tried to keep alive a consciousness of Southern Africa as an area of contestation of global capitalism's writ. I don't think that was the general picture that most people who fought against apartheid had. And as a result, there's not very much left. And in fact, Canada's role in Southern Africa is primarily now to search for investment opportunities, mainly in the sector of mining in Southern Africa more generally. So, we're back to the same old bad tricks that we were involved in before apartheid disappeared, and to some extent stepped away from in the late 80s with Moroni at Moroni's lead, with some kind of limited sanctions. But now we're back at it. So I think, and that's true here too, I think, that the anti-apartheid movement, strong as it was here, primarily was an anti-apartheid movement. And on the left, there were those who pushed for an anti-apartheid, anti-racial capitalist position. But there's not too much left of that now in a very specific Southern Africa sense. There's not too much left of that. And I think that's partly because it was weak anyway. I mean, the left has always been weak in Canada or Britain or U.S., wherever it might be. And I think, the anti-apartheid movement was as weak in those terms. But it happened that apartheid was a particular enormity that could actually catch attention and people would gravitate towards as an issue that they could make sense of. Although there were people in Canada as well as here who resisted that logic, we certainly said apartheid must go. We have then added capitalism must go too, but we haven't been successful yet.
Of those of you that were on the left in the 60s, 70s, and
sure,
majority of the 80s, did you have the luxury of putting much thought into what South Africa might look like after independence, or were you so absorbed with trying to get rid of what was in place that there wasn't a lot of room for that?
Well, I think we did spend some time thinking what it might look like, because we had Mozambique as one example, which had tried, seemed to be increasingly failing to implement a progressive economic policy. But we had other situations like Namibia. Well, it wasn't that much in advance of South Africa in terms of timing, but Zimbabwe under Mugabe until in desperation he became a radical, some kind of radical in the 90s, but and in Angola, that these were countries that were not really very decolonized. So we were aware that there was a lot that could happen between the Mozambique example at its best, as we would put it, and the, say, the Namibia, Zimbabwe, Angola model liberation, quote, at its worst, if I can use that phrase. So we were aware that the future was open. And we could also tell during the 80s that the ANZ was increasingly comfortable with the idea of a false decolonization, recolonization. I mean, we had also the experience of the whole continent behind us. That did, of course, people on the continent itself. But, you know, Frantz Fanon, to me, was always a key writer and theorist of what had happened. And he wrote, and as you recall, in Wretched of the Earth in the 1960s, that independence in most of Africa, southern Africa being different because the white settlers dug their heels in Portuguese colonialism, that he wrote and said, well, what we're happening is a false decolonization. Well, I think that isn't quite the term I use now, because I don't think that that South Africa was falsely decolonized, which would mean that whoever was formerly in charge remains in charge economically, even though they get political power. I think it's much more a globalized empire of capital, as I've called it, that now controls the game that South African elites have chosen to play. But it's the same reality: false decolonization, recolonization. It's a continuity of the overall economic system with a change of racial coloration at the top in the political ranks. And I think we were aware of that. It was always tricky, however, because you didn't want to blunt your charge against apartheid or the structures of Portuguese colonialism by saying, well, wait a minute, this could not work out that well, because we knew anything would be better than the structures of racial oppression. Those had to go. We said we hope and we think that the sociologic of the struggle against racism could lead to progressive outcomes. And in Mozambique, briefly, they did. Rhetorically, all the movements seemed to be of the left. We could tell that many of them really weren't. So I think we thought it might happen, but in South Africa, we weren't 100% confident. And in fact, sufficiently so that our whole critical support approach, which was to keep raising questions, even though we supported the ANC, became a target of the Canadian Communist Party. I don't want to overstate their importance, but I remember a couple of friends of mine who had worked a little bit with Tikhosek were also members of the Canadian CP, and they were called into the office by the head of the Canadian CP, Cashton, and said, could you start a new anti-apartheid movement in Toronto and in Canada more generally to take Tikhosek out of the game, displace Tikhosek? And they did start. These two guys refused to do it, but some people in the CP eventually did start a Canadians Concerned About Southern Africa, whose model was the anti-apartheid movement here, but they really didn't work that well. Canada's a big place, and regionalisms are quite strong, and so on. People were going to be bullied into a national organization that they wasn't really controlled from below, as we had predicted. And we were the Toronto Committee, as I said earlier, and we were linked to a whole lot of things that were happening, not least in Quebec, where it's a whole different world and a whole different political culture and different kinds of dynamics. But we had links with them there, but we were not about to say we were a national organization that controlled the Quebec picture. The CCSA had that in mind, but it didn't work. But that was, I think, where we were working. We were trying to keep our wits about us. And I think we did, you know, we did critique Mulroney from the left, and we did raise questions about what was actually happening. And we were quick to pick up on the fact that the ANC was not doing anything too very progressive once it began to get close to power. Even Mandela, if you recall, I remember I was on CBC TV when he came out of prison. I was asked to come down and be a commentator on it. So we had the scene of his leaving prison and speaking at Cape Town, and he, myself and the commentator were giving some comments about what was happening. And in his speech, he, you know, reiterated the Freedom Charter, we're going to nationalize the mines, we're going to do this. Well, it didn't last very long, because the movement itself had already taken a pretty clear position in its own mind, not necessarily entirely publicly, but publicly enough that capital had begun to breathe easy, that the ANC is somebody we can deal with. And before you knew it, Mandela was more or less on the same page, because his own... And again, you see, it's difficult, because you don't want to... Mandela's a noble guy, you know, he's a hero, there's no question about that. But he wasn't a socialist. And in the end, that may be as important, the fact that he wasn't a socialist may be as important as the fact that he was an incredibly courageous anti-apartheid struggler. So, you know, because I don't think people have gained quite as much from doing away with apartheid as they might have hoped.
And how do you see the way things have gone in Mozambique since independence?
Well, I think, I mean, they had a run. They made some mistakes, but it was still much too vanguardist organization. I think they had to risk more democracy. Because unless people really took ownership of the project, in the long run, they could talk themselves to their blue in the face. They were still telling people, and even to some degree forcing people, to do what was good for them. And it doesn't work. We know that from the 20th century history. You know, to try and bully people into doing what's best for them is a recipe for doing the worst for them. And I think Frelimo made that error. They were not Democrats in any way. They were rhetorically for liberating the people, but they weren't very good at empowering the people. They had a few brief moments of attempting that too, but they didn't go very far. So they had some interesting economic and other policies, but they were pretty... It's hard to determine it exactly, because there was some variables. One was, it was a very backward country thanks to the Portuguese. It was also one that was under threat and under fire from apartheid, and from Rhodesia, and then from South Africa itself. So it was a state caught on its back foot by external variables. And then they made some mistakes too. So, you know, it's an overdetermined situation, which means that all of these things are determining. And so they didn't have the best chance in the world to realize the best thoughts they had. But it has turned into be a pretty predictable... I mean, I think, unfortunately, you can almost say Fanon is right for Southern Africa. That they've been, well, I'd say recolonized rather than falsely decolonized, because Portugal's not absent, but it's not the major player. Insofar as there's a global fix on Mozambique, it's the fix of global capital, not of whatever might have been left of Portuguese colonialism. So that kind of language and reality of nationally based imperialisms is no longer as prominent. Even the United States is not quite the solo player in charge of the global capitalist situation as it might have seemed at one stage. Now it's part of the global mix too. It's global capital that we're talking about. And with local elites affiliating themselves, as Fanon said, to the false decolonization, well, they're affiliating themselves beneficiaries of the outreach of global capital. But the problem with global capital is that the kind of things it wants from Africa don't carry it very deep into the society in terms of transforming things. And I think that's where they're stuck. So I think that's true in Mozambique, certainly. And what you then get is a political elite that is quite corrupt. And insofar as they aren't corrupt, they aren't quite a national bourgeoisie. They haven't got a national development. They attach themselves, insofar as they're active in the private sector, to global undertakings as kind of subcontractors. So you have a pretty messy situation in Southern Africa, in which, to some degree, in say in a country like Mozambique, the national product rises. But the product for most people in the society doesn't rise. The national product rises, and most of the profits are skimmed off abroad or consumed by the local elites. Very little transformation of people's lives is taking place, except for the ill that takes place when they take over areas and transform them for capitalist interests. So, I mean, I'm still an old-style socialist, I suppose, and perhaps a bit too predictable, but I think that this is not a system that's working for the most people in Southern Africa. And certainly that's true in South Africa. It's not working. And just to come back to what we're talking about, I think Ruth would have seen that too. But not only seen it, as Rusty Bernstein increasingly did, but maybe just have begun to speak out about it too. Now, even Rusty Bernstein wrote me this astonishing letter, but he never really said anything too very public. I've since published that letter, but I think the loyalty, the importance of the anti-apartheid struggle, you have to be very clear about that. This is an important thing to do, to get rid of these racists who are in charge. It's another thing to say, then, let's get rid of the capitalists who helped make this happen so we can really be genuinely liberated, and then liberate ourselves in terms of democratic voice and gender assertions and the like. And not too many people have moved to that stage. Rusty Bernstein seemed to be moving towards that stage just before his death. But that's 20 years after Ruth's. And if you could see the Bernsteins as in some way the same generation as Ruth and Joe. It took him that long to come clean, in a way, with himself, primarily. And even then, not too assertively, so it's hard. When you have a loyalty to a real cause, who are these fucking whiteies to be telling everybody what to do? It's real. I mean, I don't want to downgrade that instinct at all. That's very important, to fight against that. Many of them fought against capitalism too. Whether they would have still kept fighting against capitalism, or how they would have done so, what they would have said, anybody's guess.
At the time that you were in Mozambique with Ruth First, what was your regular interaction with her, or working relationship with her?
Well, you see, again, this, I am a bit here on false pretenses, because I didn't work directly, closely with her. I wasn't in the Center of African Studies, so the people like Bridget and Anna Maria and Mark and Colin that you've spoken with were there day to day, working quite closely with her. I was, however, just around the hall from her office, so I did see her quite regularly, and I was quite well aware of what was happening in the Center of African Studies. But I was in no way accountable to her, and we had our own struggles, because I was in the faculty of Marxism-Leninism. The leadership of the faculty was Luis de Brito, who was a Mozambican, and there were several other Mozambicans, and they smelled a rat with what was being taught in the name of Marxism-Leninism, because the main teachers were East German and Bulgarian, and so they were Eastern Europeans, and they had an Eastern European Marxism, which I was particularly uncomfortable with, and De Brito as well. So my experience was more struggling on that front, and at the party school, the same kind of thing. You're trying to teach against the current, and I was invited, I think, by George Rebello, who was the head secretary for Lima for political work, in part to provide an alternative voice to this Eastern European. But this interview is not about me. But it did mean that I wasn't really a player in the Center of African Studies, other than at a distance. Where I did come up against her, but it's hard for me to reconstruct it, at that conference that was held just before her death. I gave a paper, and I was kind of heterodox, I guess. but I was raising some questions about what was happening in Southern Africa as a whole. And I remember, now this in a way probably isn't for the record, but I think Ruth was uncomfortable. She was always very friendly. We got along well. But I think she was uncomfortable with my position. I was not quite as, I don't know what the word would be. I think my position wasn't exactly hers, put it that way. And I'm not quite sure now in retrospect where the difference lays altogether. But I, you know, I was more skeptical than she could probably confess herself to be of what the ANC was doing, for example, generally. And so that, there were differences, but not antagonisms. But at this conference, but you see, I can't really reconstruct what I said at the conference, but I know I gave a paper that she didn't particularly approve of. And I remember Joe Slovo was in the conference. He was very critical from the floor. We had a bit of a sparring match at the conference over the content of the paper. And Dan O'Mara, who was teaching in the Center of African Studies and was doing research there, he told me later, he was designated by Ruth to criticize me, to be the critic from the floor alongside Joe, whatever it was that I was saying. Now this is not very helpful because I can't remember exactly what it was about, but he afterwards apologized to me and said he thought I was closer to the mark perhaps than the official line that Ruth was pushing. But I see it's a kind of a hopeless anecdote because I can't quite remember what the issues were. I mean, everything just faded because the day after was the explosion, so it's all kind of become a very fuzzy memory for me. But I remember that was, there was a tension there over some issues that we were talking about. I think it had to do with the dangers of a false decolonization, recolonization, still hovering over Mozambique unless they made it work, still hovering over South Africa unless they pushed certain things. This is now the early 80s, so a lot of changes taking place. It was in the wake of Soweto, so there was obviously a stirring inside, but before the 84-86 period of resistance inside the country. So it was a kind of a twilight zone of change. You could see that change was going to take place in part, and perhaps even centrally, and I think it is true, within the country. There were trade unions, there was civic organizations that were speaking out, and they weren't necessarily speaking out as direct agents of the ANC. That was going to be a long-term struggle. I've written about that elsewhere and so on. I think I may have been foreshadowing, but again, I haven't got a copy of that paper and I have no idea what I said. But I remember it was contested, and she was contesting it too. So I think that we obviously didn't agree on everything that was taking place, and certainly Joe didn't, although again, I got along with him quite well too, and Dan didn't. Agree, although I think in the long run he actually did, but he, you know, this is, his duty was as a defend the center's line or something, I can't remember, but he felt a little bit badly about the role he was felt constrained to play as a functionary of the center. But this is all hazy, and none of it, I think the interesting thing is that although there was a disagreement on that and other things, Ruth, I think as several people said at the conference, the kind of person who could disagree with you one day very forcefully, but the next day she didn't forget about it, but she didn't harbor it either. She knew that these were tough questions that in which there were different emphases and so on, and the next day you were as likely to be back to being a comrade again without equivocation as much as being a person who differed with her. So she had a good attitude in that regard, and I think it wasn't necessarily the attitude that always took place within the ANC. And that's part of the reason why she didn't, you know, Joe Slovo was quoted as saying at this conference, saying if she hadn't been my wife, she might have been expelled from the party. Well, you know, I think that was her general attitude. She would tended to, if she thought you were wrong, she would say it very forcefully. She was tough. But she would listen too, which is no small thing. And she would not, forgive is not the right word, but she would absorb that as part of the ongoing contestation that this is complicated work, there are real differences, there's debates to be had, discussions to be had. And I think she was of that persuasion. She could be tough and even a little bit ruthless upon occasion, I would guess. And I certainly saw some of that. But she listened and she cared. That was the main thing. And she cared about people as well as about the struggle. So it was not a bad thing to say about somebody, I think.
What was your work when you were there?
Well, I wrote a book, actually, for the program called, I forget what it was called, but it was something like A Mozambican Approach to Marxism-Leninism or something.
This is for the development program?
Yeah, well, no, it was for the program in, not for that their school, but okay, for the Faculty of Marxism-Leninism. Okay. Because they were giving courses in Marxism-Leninism, mm-hmm. but very strictly orthodox ones. Somebody said, apparently one student at one point said, taking a course in Marxism-Leninism from these Eastern European professors was a bit like taking a medicine against a cold. You had one lecture in Marxism-Leninism. You were being immunized against Marxism-Leninism. A second lesson, you were that much closer to being immunized. A third lesson, you were cured. And that was a bit the way they taught. It was not really very open or useful. And I can remember once at a faculty meeting, I had said something about, I was teaching about the relationship between the mode of production, relationship of production and the forces of production. And of course the communists from Eastern Europe tended to emphasize the forces of production, if you get that language of a certain kind of classical Marxism. And I said, I'm trying to teach that there's more of an interplay between the forces and the relations of production. And one of these professors, I've forgotten whether it was Professor Schlaucht or Professor Schmidt, one of these two Eastern European guys launches this diatribe against me. I didn't come from a socialist country, etc., etc. And I said, so I turned to Luis, who I knew quite well, De Brito, the Mozambican head of the thing, and I said, Luis, I mean, I haven't come here to compare my revolutionary credentials with Professor Schlaucht. I mean, who cares? But it would be nice to know, is there a line in this faculty, or is it about, or can these questions be opened? And one of the professors says, we couldn't open it up for discussion about the relations and modes of production, because then the students would think we didn't have a science. Pretty staggering statement. Makes no sense at all, except if you have a very scientistic point of view. So I said to Luis, what's the line here? I mean, what should we be doing? So he thought for a minute, and then he said, now again, you may not catch the term, but I'll explain it if you don't get it. He said, this is all being done in Portuguese. He was fluent in Portuguese, of course, but the rest of us were all making these rather complex arguments in broken Portuguese. But he said, Professor Schlaucht, I think you should be aware that Professor Sol is here at the invitation of the Central Committee of Frelimo to help us in our work in the faculty here and also to teach at the party school. And that would seem to be a negation of your negation, which is a classic concept in a particularly orthodox form of Marxism, the negation of the negation. And so, it was such a neat turn. Because he's kind of taking a Marxist category and using it against them. That would seem to be a negation of me. So I didn't know whether to laugh or cry, or what to do, So I was kind of studiedly looking at the table, but I had a smile around the edges of my... And so that was the kind of thing that happened. It was not a very productive context, given the rigidity, and I would say the orthodoxy, of these people who are teaching this course. But the fact that Luis could make a joke about it, and quite an effective one, was also promising to me at the time. So, you know, I was involved. But you can see why I was so involved in these struggles and at the party school as well, that I didn't really operate on a day-to-day basis the way Bridget and Mark and Colin and these others did. I was had my own little world to concern myself. So, you know, in a way, I'm here on false pretenses. I was never as close to Ruth intellectually in terms of activity and so on as they were, but I knew her well, and I certainly was really knocked out on my pins, as everybody was, by what happened. It was a horrible, horrible event, and it's one that it doesn't go away. It's funny how some things stick for you, and that whole moment, I mean, to step out of your car and hear this explosion, you know, and to realize again a minor detail but I could have easily been room as not, so it came, brought it particularly close, and but the enormity of it and the importance of her loss is impossible to overstate, I would say. So, you know, I'm very pleased to have been here, even if there are others who are perhaps more qualified to speak to her reality directly. I mean, I knew her well enough and was close enough to the whole process to have it still. I can still feel it, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a hard thing. This brings it to the surface, this whole conference. Is very well done, I think, the workshop, but it's also bittersweet. I mean, I said that at the very outset of my talk, you know, this would be a glorious occasion if it weren't so sad a one as well.
Was it possible for you from a distance to tell what kind of changes there were within the center or within work in Mozambique after Ruth's death?
Well, I don't think it was Ruth's death herself changed the overall framework too much. I mean, it obviously took a person who was incredibly skilled and active away, so that, and again, others can talk about how they found the working relationship much more accurately than I can. Of course, the whole situation of Mozambique was changing. So this is 82, 84, they signed the Nkomati Accord because they're under pressure from South Africa. The ANC has to, in effect, move out, move to Angola, so that Mozambique can try to establish some kind of peace with. But these are all things happening much in a much broader scale than anything Ruth or I were doing. I'd be interested to know, but I've never really pursued it, what happened to the center's projects that were under in train when Ruth was alive. But there were competent people like Mark and Bridget and so on. These were strong people. So it wasn't as if the world came to a stop. And there was Dan O'Mara and Rob Davies in one other corner of the Center of African Studies doing very good work on South Africa, and they published several books. And out of that experience, Rob Davies has gone on to be a minister in the South African government and so on. So, you know, there was a lot happening, and it continued to happen, I think, but slowly but surely the ground shifted quite dramatically. The Center of African Studies does continue, and I'm not quite sure what it's doing now, because my own, in a way, following the from this, I mean, I became more and more concerned about South Africa, because it was clear that a lot of the prospects for Mozambique certainly depended on what happened in South Africa. Even though by the time South Africa became freed from apartheid, it was part of the problem rather than part of the solution, I think. And Mozambique had also become part of the problem rather than the solution, the states in both countries. But so I ceased to be quite as involved in Mozambique and became more involved in South African-related events. And I continued to write. I wrote an article last year on Mozambique on some of the more recent developments, but not a very positive one. It was in the Review of African Economy. So I continued to keep in touch with that situation, but I had spent, and then subsequently went to Todd in South Africa at Wits in the early part of the century, 2000 and something, but I've been back and forth with South Africa. Well, I've been back and forth four times in the last 14 months, so I'm still, I don't think I'll be able to go very much more because so far, but you know, so I'm still thinking Southern Africa. And of course, even now, as we talked about earlier, South Africa is at the heart of what happens to the region as a whole. I'm doing a book for Cambridge on the 30 Years' War for Southern African Liberation. I see it as part of a unity, in a sense, that whole area of contestation, Angola, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, South Africa. That Southern African cone is a sort of a single area of war and other kinds of linkages. I think that's still true. You know, there's still logic to that southern part. At the moment, the logic is being driven by global capital, by South African sub-imperialism, and by local elite aggrandizement. But it can't last forever. The contradictions are pretty great, so we live in hope. The struggle continues, as we said several times at the conference. You know, la lutte continue. Vamos faire. We will see.